and found that Lindsay had left. Yuki said,
"She said sorry, but she had to get home."
"Oh man, I wanted to talk to her,"
Cindy said.
"You might still be able to catch her if you run."
Cindy said, "Be right back," and bolted out the door and down to Montgomery. She looked in both directions for Lindsay's car and saw her Explorer coming back towards Susie's in the opposite lane. Cindy waved to her. Lindsay slowed to a stop and said, "I'm racing, Sin. Mrs. Rose has a date with her daughter and has to leave any minute. Call you tomorrow?"
"Okay," Cindy said. "Talk soon."
Cindy had work to do before she slept, and that was putting her into a panic. She had wanted to let Lindsay know she was going to run a story on the sudden deaths that looked like heart attacks and probably weren't. She didn't need Lindsay's permission. Nothing said at the table was off the record, and besides, she already had a good handle on the piece. Weeks ago, Claire had put out a bolo on the Medical Examiner's network, seeking information about needle marks on people who appeared to have died suddenly with no known cause. Other people had access to this network. The Chronicle subscribed to it, for instance, and so did the Daily News. Cindy had asked Rich for confirmation, which he had given her. He hadn't told her anything confidential, but she had known she was onto something when Sarah Nugent, only 41 years old, died 2 days ago in front of her hotel. Cause of death unknown. Lindsay was the primary investigator on the case. It was SOP to get a quote from her, but Cindy didn't need it. What she needed to do was get the story out before another paper ran it. As for the empty vial marked succinylcholine, she could write that the tip had come from an anonymous source close to the investigation. But should she? Should she write the story without Lindsay saying, "Sure, go for it"? Cindy went back to the restaurant and joined the girls for key lime pie and tea. Off the record hardly applied, as she didn't hear a thing her friends were saying. She was thinking of Lindsay. With or without Lindsay's permission, she had to write the story. Journalism wasn't a hobby. It was a job with a responsibility to the public to write the truth. Plus, it was her job. After the check had been paid, Cindy called Rich and let him know that she was on the way home. As she drove, she organized the story in her mind and thought she could have it in the publisher's inbox before he got his morning coffee. When she was a block from home, she tried calling Lindsay, and when she didn't pick up, she left a message.
"Linz, call me, please. I want to run the Sarah Nugent story and talk about the formerly presumed heart attacks. I'm not going to mention Claire by name, but I could sure use a quote from you."
The story was writing itself inside her head. Cindy couldn't wait to start putting the words down. Chapter 68. I was making breakfast for Julie with the TV on in the background when I heard reporter Susan Steinhardt of Channel 5 say, "This just in. A number of deaths in San Francisco originally attributed to heart failure appear instead to have been murders." "Say that again?" I dialed down the stove and amped up the volume. Ms. Steinhardt was on set, dark hair perfectly waved, coolly delivering her report, which felt anything but cool to me. She said, "Senior crime writer Cindy Thomas of the San Francisco Chronicle broke this story only minutes ago. She writes that as many as 5 victims have died from injections of a paralytic drug called succinylcholine. According to Ms. Thomas, who gave her sources as individuals close to the investigation, the victims were assaulted on the street and injected with this drug by an unknown attacker," Steinhardt said. "We'll bring you news updates as they come to us." No way. Cindy had gone public with our investigation. I grabbed my phone and called Cindy, and as soon as she said hello, I went off on her, all guns blazing. "Cindy, what the hell? You put out the suck story? The killer now knows we're onto him. You just made our investigation harder or impossible, so congrats on your scoop, and thank you very much." Then I clicked off. Besides dropping them in the toilet, the worst thing about cell phones is that you can't pound them into the cradle. But I slapped my phone down hard on the counter anyway before returning to Julie's oatmeal. Just then, Mrs. Rose arrived in a cloud of tea rose perfume, calling out,
"Girls, I'm here."
When she saw the look on my face, she said,
"You okay?"
"Not really."
"Is Julie okay?"
"She's fine."
I'll be right back, said Mrs. Rose.
She leashed a bounding, leaping, squealing Martha and took her out for her walk. My phone buzzed. I hesitated. Then I answered it.
What, Cindy?
What?
Listen to me, Lindsay, she said.
The days of you telling me what I can and cannot do are officially over.
Don't give me that.
I am giving it to you, and if you can't take it, we can't be friends.
I was so stunned by her indignation and her anger, I really had no comeback. She said,
First, I tried to talk to you, twice, on the street, remember? And then I called and left a message. You didn't get back. More to the point, I'm not a cub reporter anymore, and I'm not your little sister. You know how many crimes I've solved with you and with Rich? Many. Remember? I shot a killer who had a gun pointed at you. I killed someone. I got shot.
I remember, I said. My tone had dropped a little. I wasn't sure she heard me.
I play by the rules, said Cindy. I didn't know about the sucks until Claire said so, but I didn't use her name. And by the way, I had this story by the balls before dinner last night. Claire put it out herself to every Emmy and pathologist in the state. If I hadn't broken it, someone else would have. I did my job. That's all I have to say, Lindsay. I'm done justifying my integrity and my work to you.
I couldn't speak. I was still mad, but shame was starting to heat the back of my neck and direct my eyes to the floor. And then the phone went dead. I cleaned up my little girl and got ready for work. I tried to ignore my panged conscience, but I couldn't let myself get away with it. I picked up my phone and called Cindy. She didn't answer. I left a message. Sin, I'm sorry. You're right. I'm wrong. I'll call you later, but I need to apologize now. Don't stay mad. We can work this out. Call me. Chapter 69. Nettie found the newspaper in the basement trash room lying next to the mountain of garbage bags. The headline came at him fast and hard like a sucker punch. Stealth Killer Stalks Our City. Was that him? He snatched up the paper and read the story fast. The victim was Sarah Nugent, the woman he'd stuck outside the hotel. There was a photo of her and her husband, and quotes from the doorman and... No, 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 no. Law enforcement had found the vial of sucks. He must have fumbled it when he tried to put it back into his pocket. The paper shook and rattled in Nettie's hands as he skimmed the second page of the article. Had there been a witness? Had he been seen? He found nothing but the two words describing what he'd done. Stealth Killer. He liked the name. It sounded epic. It sounded like a movie title. William H. Macy would play him. Edward Lamborghini. Oh, man. But as thrilling as the thought was, he was also afraid. Over all this time and so many kills, he'd wished for recognition. Now he might get it. Was he ready to pay?
Cool it, Nettie, he said to himself. Cool your jets.
He put the newspaper back precisely where he'd found it. He thought of the two cops questioning him at the Embarcadero. That was the first warning, and now with this newspaper story, that was warning number two. Should he stay, or should he go? If he played it safe, if he didn't overreact, he could have a beautiful night flight. He unlocked and opened the metal door to the alley, leaned against it, and considered his options. Over the past 30 years, he had mapped a three-dimensional schematic of San Francisco in his mind. He had walked the 5 square miles centering on the loony bin above and below ground. He knew every rusted lock and basement door, every alley and poorly lit path, and then he knew where he would go. He saw the place in his mind, Washington Square, with its uplifting views of Saints Peter and Paul Church, the roaming homeless and other ragtag people on the grounds. No one ever looked at him in the park. He was invisible there. He was free. The night was a pleasant 62 degrees. Nettie took some cleansing breaths, then walked north a block and a half to Joyce Street, an alley with a grate where the asphalt met the curb. He had chiseled open this grate on an earlier excursion, and he pried it open now. Metal creaked, and he dropped inside a drafty opening, holding onto the curb until he found footing on the metal ladder. He heard water dripping, and cool air came up to greet him as he entered the new, still-under-construction tunnel for the central subway. The tunnel was enormous. He pulled his penlight from a pocket and flicked it over the heavy machinery parked in the dark, the lifts and the auger and the backhoes. Then he headed north between the just-laid train tracks. Rats scurried. His running shoes slapped at the low tide. He kept his light on the newly poured concrete walls looking for the exit, and then his light kissed the ladder on the wall. Nettie put the end of his penlight between his teeth and climbed 30 feet, hand over hand, finally shouldering open the drain. A moment later, he took in the sweet air and the expansive freedom of his night flight. He ran. He pushed off walls and took the peaks and valleys of San Francisco's exciting topography. He was still flying when he reached Cordelia Street. He slowed and drafted behind 3 teenage boys, staying back and at the same time with them as they joked and laughed and horsed around all the way to Powell. Nettie was imagining his entrance to the park, deep in his thoughts, eyes down, when he whumped into something soft and resilient. It was a very large dude.
"Hey, watch where you're going,"
said the big man, who looked to Nettie like a grown old high school football player. Then he added the zinger.
"Are you crazy?"
"I'm good. My fault,"
Nettie said, jacking up his voice to his falsetto range. The big dude bent to gather up his briefcase, his newspaper, and continued on. Then, as if a new thought had struck him, he stopped and turned to look at Nettie. Nettie thought he understood why. That newspaper headline, "Stealth Killer," and something about Nettie had made the big dude think too much. He had seen the predatory intelligence in his eyes, the look that Nettie always tried to hide. And the big dude was paralyzed by that look. Nettie thought he'd been recognized. He said it out loud.
"Uh-oh."
Quick, his hand was in his pocket, where he wrapped his fist around a loaded sharp. He'd never had a bit of trouble before, but the big dude was looking right at him. This was different. The guy wanted to fight. He outweighed Nettie by 60 pounds. But so what? Nettie was ready. He looked at the big dude and said,
"Game on."
Part 4. Chapter 70. Conklin and I were working at our desks when Claire came through the squad room door wearing a bloody gown and a cap, her mask pulled down, and it appeared that she had something big on her mind. I said, "You've got a report on that sucks vial?" She said, "I'm still waiting. I need you to come on over to my house. There's someone I want you to see."
"Something wrong with your phone?"
Conklin asked my BFF.
"My calls, Inspector, went to voicemail. That would be my calls to the both of you."
"Oh." The three of us thundered down the fire stairs, cut through the back door, and strode along the breezeway to Claire's house, the offices of the chief medical examiner. We passed through the waiting room, brushing by her gatekeeper and the loosely packed mob of law enforcement officers waiting to see Claire. She put up a hand and didn't skip a step, as good as saying, "Not now." We passed Claire's office and continued down the corridor until she stiff-armed the stainless steel swinging doors to the super chilly autopsy suite. Rich and I stayed with her, stopping at the table with the body lying on it face up under the lights. Claire said,
"The needle sticker has stuck again. At least it sure looks like it. Meet Ralph Beardsley, CPA, DOA, RIP.
Mr. Beardsley was a black male, about 50, heavyset.
"Look here," Claire said, turning the man's head to the side.
There was a bite mark in his neck. Claire pulled down the sheet and showed me a bruise with a needle mark centered on his left pectoral. I said,
"Whoa.
Is this the first time the needle sticker has struck in the front of the body?"
"To the best of my knowledge."
"So this was a confrontation," I said. "The victim saw his killer."
"No doubt. And they mixed it up."
She bunched the sheets over his privates and showed us the rest of him. She pointed out other fresh bruises, 4 by my count. One under the ribcage, a big one on his side, one high on his right thigh, and one on his left shin.
I've got some good news.
I looked up at Claire. I couldn't even guess.
Some living folks saw the killer in action.
Say that again.
There are witnesses?
Claire said. Husband and wife saw the hit from their car. They flagged down a cruiser.
Here, she said, handing me a scrap of paper. Fresh contact info. Get it while it's hot.
Chapter 71. The witnesses, Lynn and Ray Schultz, were in their 30s, owned a liquor store in North Beach, and given the annual stats of liquor store robberies, I was betting that the Schultzes were quite observant. Conklin and I set them up with coffee in interview 2, took chairs across from them, and got to work. Ray Schultz said,
Last night, sometime after 9, we're going home from the store. I'm driving. It's dark, and I'm watching the street. Lynn, you tell them, honey.
Lynn Schultz said,
So we were stopped at the light on Union Street.
She drew a line on the table with her blue polished fingernail.
I'm staring out the window at some free furniture on the sidewalk, and I see this kind of small, kind of weird looking guy wearing dark clothes walking with his eyes down. Here.
She stabbed a ding in the table at an imaginary point along her imaginary road.
He bumps into Mr. Beardsley, who drops his newspaper and his briefcase.
Lynn Schultz was quite animated now. She said,
The paper blows all over and Mr. Big looks pissed. The two of them are like 5-6 feet apart, facing off. I think, OMG, and I roll down the window so I can hear, and Mr. Big calls the other one a name, like, you crazy little shrimp or something. And the little guy goes, bring it on, and gets right up into Mr. Big's face. I mean, like, aggressive and, yeah, crazy. Mr. Big could make 2 of the other guy. And Mr. Big shoves Mr. Little away with his forearm.
The husband said,
I didn't see that, but what Lynn is describing is a football move, like the way a defensive lineman would push away a blocker. It's called a forearm shiver.
And the little one goes down, said Lynn Schultz, and he gets up slowly like he's been hurt and stands there for a second with his hands on his knees, and then bang, he leaps at Mr. Big like a tomcat, and it looks like he bites him on his neck, and that throws Mr. Big off balance, and now he's down.
Lynn Schultz was acting it all out now.
And the small guy, he's on the ground, like leaning on his elbow, and from that position, he launches this sweeping kick and gets the big guy in the shin right here,
she said, patting her leg just below the knee.
The big guy lands on his back, and in a split second, the little one is on top of him, raises his arm high, and looks like he punches Mr. Big in the chest.
Good God. That answered my question of how and why Mr. Beardsley had gotten a needle in his pec muscle. Ray Schultz was saying,
I'm seeing this now. Mr. Big yowls, and he's in trouble. Now the light turns green, horns are honking. I start to go, but Lynn yells at me to pull over to the curb and do something. So I pull over, I get out. The little guy has gone, nowhere to be seen. And I run over, get down next to Mr. Beardsley, who's clutching his throat, trying to get his breath, but he can't get enough air. He says, call 911. My phone's in the car, but I run out into the road and wave down a cruiser.
I was thrilling inside. I could see the whole scene going down almost in front of me.
These witnesses were good.
I asked the Schultzes, You're sure the smaller man was the attacker? Said Lynn Schultz.
Definitely, 100%.
Okay. If you could, describe him once more, as best as you can, I said.
Sure. Estimating he could be about 5'2", light-colored hair, like faded blonde. He had a collar or a hoodie under his coat. Damn shame I didn't see his face.
Conklin said,
You've given us a lot, Lynn. Our first good lead.
I made notes, including that Beardsley had been carrying a newspaper. If the headline had read Stealth Killer, maybe it had sparked Beardsley's curiosity. Had he made the killer and the killer knew it? So he took Beardsley out? Conklin was saying,
If you think of anything else, anything at all, call my direct line. Thanks very much for coming in.
We had beautiful, corroborated eyewitness reports and a decent description of the needle sticker. It was, as Conklin had said, our first good lead. It was better than I could even have wished for. But we needed more. The weird-looking guy was volatile and sounded like he was also fearless. He was striking out much more frequently than before, as far as we knew. How many of our citizens had died as a direct result of this killer? More than 2 months after Claire had found a bruise on Lois Sprague's buttock, we had no more idea who the needle sticker was than we had then. 4 more people had died. The killer was on a roll. Chapter 72. Connor Grant's complaint to internal affairs haunted me all day and cut my sleep short every night as I waited to be interviewed by Lieutenant William Hoyt. That Monday morning, Carol Hanna, my tough, dedicated union rep, came to interview one, and we went over everything I said and did when I arrested Connor Grant, and everything I had done or been accused of doing since I joined the police force as a rookie. Carol said,
"I don't see anything to this complaint except that Connor Grant wants revenge. If I'm missing something, please tell me now."
"The whole episode lasted 10 minutes, I told my advocate. "I've thought about every second of it, and I followed procedure. I'm sure of it, Carol." Carol said,
"If Hoyt goes over the line, I'll intervene."
The way a complaint to IAB was processed was pretty straightforward. I would be interviewed, and my interview would be compared with reports from other sources and my personal file to see if there was a hinky pattern of behavior. If I'd broken the law, IAB would go to the DA, and if Parisi found that there was cause to try me for these crimes or infractions of police procedure, there would be a trial before the police commission. I would be suspended from my job until the case was adjudicated, but even if the charges were dismissed, my reputation would be permanently damaged. In other words, it would be a living, breathing nightmare that made me sick even to think about. Connor Grant had thrown me under a steaming pile of bull, and my preparation with my union rep and having her at my side would be my best chance to get out from under it. That afternoon, Carol and I went downstairs to the district attorney's offices, and Parisi's assistant walked us down the hallway to his private conference room, gave us each a bottle of water, and closed the door. I took a seat. Carol sat down beside me, and we waited. 15 minutes felt like 15 years as I watched the second hand tick by on the wall clock. Then there was a tap on the door, and Lieutenant Hoyt came in with a man he introduced as Sergeant Kreisler. Hoyt was bald, sharp-featured, and about as warm and fuzzy as a hockey puck. Kreisler had a full head of hair and a rosy complexion. He was a little too warm and fuzzy, like he was enjoying the very idea of this meeting. Carol set up a recorder and pushed the play button, and Kreisler did the same. Hoyt said to me,
"Sergeant Boxer, we're going to cover a lot of ground in this meeting. A complaint against you is a complaint against the entire police force, you understand. So don't take it personally. Or take it personally, I don't care. I just want to get to the truth. You know the charges?
False arrest, lying, making up a confession resulting in a trial."
"Good enough,"
said Hoyt.
"Let's begin."
For the next 2 hours, William Hoyt tore apart my career in homicide, case by case. The third hour was dedicated to one case in particular, the teenage girl I'd shot to death because I'd had no choice. Warren Jacoby had been my partner then, and that cute young lady had led us on a high-speed car chase through the Tenderloin. As I said, she was cute, deceptively so. When caught, she got out of her father's $60,000 car and reached for her learner's permit. She pulled out a gun. She shot me and Jacoby. I was in bad shape, and Jacoby was worse, unconscious and bleeding out onto the asphalt. The young lady was still shooting when I managed to free my gun from its holster and return fire. A 15-year-old would-be cop killer had gone down. Despite my entirely justifiable self-defense shooting, her rich family had sued me for wrongful death, and I'd been tried in civil court. It was a horrible experience. Those same feelings of frustration and injustice were coming over me now. I answered Hoyt's questions about the shooting. I had fired in self-defense. I regretted that I'd had to kill that girl, but the situation had demanded it. Yes, 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 I had shot several other people in the last few years, and all those shootings had been fully justified, and there had been no resulting disciplinary or legal action. I stayed cool and went on to answer many questions about my critically important first-time meeting with Connor Grant. I said explicitly that I was sure I had heard him correctly when he told me that he had blown up Cytron. I asked him to repeat himself. He elaborated on his boasts. I read him his rights and asked him if he understood. He said he did. I turned him over to patrolmen I knew, who brought him to my CO, who was waiting for him in booking. Everything I said and did was by the book.
His word against yours, but we have your husband's sworn statement. And that will be considered, said Hoyt. I think we have enough for today.
Tape recorders were turned off. Carol and I left the conference room first, and when we were walking up the stairs, she said to me,
Perfect job, Lindsay. You answered honestly and with conviction. I don't see anything here but a dismissal of the complaint.
I couldn't even smile. I remembered when Parisi, Yuki, Brady, and I had had the same slam dunk feeling that Grant's on-scene confession would convict him. Now I knew what the science teacher could do in a court of law. If Hoyt wanted to bring the charge forward, he would do it. If Parisi, for political reasons, had to let it go to the police commission, I could be sacrificed for the greater good of clearing the department's name. I would be fired, made an example of, humiliated, and I would likely never have a job in law enforcement again. The end. Chapter 73. That weekend, Joe and I relaxed within the landscaped embrace of Pacifica Rehab's garden patio. He was in his wheelchair. I was stretched out in a high-quality ergonomic lounger beside him, and while we talked together, we were watching Julie. Our little Bambina was in the kiddie pool with three other kiddos, including Joey, a boy of four who had made up a sea monster game. He was in the starring role and had instructed the others to evade and scream. Fearless, Julie sat on the steps, slapped the water, and giggled. Joe and I laughed, too. It was all sunshine with a side of butterflies in the garden. But as I told Joe about my interrogation by internal affairs, my mind spiraled down into a darker place. I said, I was grilled on a spit, and Hoyt just kept basting me, jacking up the flame. Sorry to even have to tell you about it.
You'll be okay, and I hope they want to interview me, but I know this is very stressful. I'm here. Tell me everything.
Okay, I said. So Hoyt curls his lip and says to me, I don't understand your answer, Sergeant. The scene was chaotic. You're so certain that you remember Mr. Grant's utterance verbatim? I said, It wasn't an utterance, Mr. Hoyt. It was a speech. It was a brag. It was a confession without coercion. He complimented me on the alliteration. Then he said,
Sounds a little rehearsed, Sergeant. Let me ask you something else. Have you ever made a mistake on the job? Arrested the wrong person? Shot someone dead? How many people have you killed, Sergeant Boxer? Three? More than that? Fewer than 10?
He knew how many, Joe. It was a tactic.
Of course it was. Keep going.
I took a breath and told Joe what I could bear to remember.
Why were you demoted from lieutenant to sergeant? Why were you passed over for the job as chief of police? Why should we believe anything you say about anything?
Joe sighed.
Sorry, Linz. Look, the public wants cops to take lunatics off the street, and you did that. Your responsibility stops there.
As we talked about our personal lunatic, I realized that I still hadn't fully accepted what Grant had said to the jurors when he told them that the scope of the Cytron bombing was way beyond the abilities of a ninth-grade science teacher. So had he really done it? If so, how? And how had he managed to annihilate Red Dog Parisi at trial? We'd never really known Connor Grant. He'd been investigated by the FBI, by DHS, and still what we knew about the science teacher could cover the face of a 3-inch square post-it note. Joe and I had barely touched our sandwiches and chips. He said,
All done?
I'll get it, Joe, I said, referring to the remains of our lunch. He said, absolutely deadpan.
Allow me.
And then the best and most amazing thing happened. Joe got out of his wheelchair and onto his feet as if nothing had ever been wrong with him. He walked. He emptied the remains of our lunch into the trash, stowed the trays in the receptacle, and then he spun around and did a little dance. Julie flew up out of the pool like a June bug and yelled,
Daddy!
Joe opened his arms and she ran toward him, chirping,
Daddy, dance!
They danced. He twirled her under his arm. They made up their own moves. From first step to last, the prancing and twirling went on for only a minute. But it was the cutest damned minute of my life. Chapter 74. Nettie was still hurting like crazy from when that giant son of a bitch had blocked him, making him fall and hit his head on the pavement. His head was still radiating with pain. He had no intention of letting anyone know. He went through the whole weekend being Nutty Nettie, playing cards and doing stupid Nettie tricks, but he was sore in more ways than one. When he'd been leaving the grown-up football player on Union Street, he'd seen a man jump out of a car at the light and head over to the dead or dying man. Had the man from the car seen his face? Well, shit. Didn't matter. Nettie had gotten clean away. Now it was after dinner in Ward 666, and just before lights out. Nettie, Mikey, Quarter to Ten, Fred Mouse, and Oscar were going to trade stories. Oscar was in the bathroom when Mikey leaned over to where Nettie was settling into his bunk and dropped a bombshell. He said,
"I told Dr. Hoover a story about you, Nettie. A true one."
Nettie was zapped with a jolt of fear like a lightning strike that ran up his spine to the back of his head, then branched out to his fingertips. He felt dizzy. He tried to focus on Mikey.
"What story?" he managed to ask.
Nettie hoped that Mikey would say that he had told Hoover a Johnston correctional story. Johnston was fact, published, documented, condemned. No harm could come to Nettie over a Johnston story. But
reality check, Nettie.
Mikey hadn't told Hoover about Johnston. Hoover knew all about Johnston.
Mikey said, "I told Dr. Hoover that you go flying at night and stay out until almost morning."
Mikey was smart enough to read Nettie's face and see trouble coming. He started backing up until he was between two lockers across from the beds. A split second later, Nettie sprang off the side of the bed, his shadow rising up against the wall like a bodyguard three times his height. Nettie closed in. Mikey peed himself.
"Why'd you do that, Mikey? What did you do that for?"
"Don't hurt me,"
he squealed.
"Don't hurt me, Nettie."
Nettie slapped a locker door. Kicked it. Then as Mikey went into a crouch, Nettie grabbed his hair with one hand, gripped his jaw with the other, forcibly extracting him from his hiding place, then ran him head first into a wall. As he fell to the floor, Mikey loosed one long, undulating wail.
"You're going to take it back,"
Nettie barked into his friend's ear. Mikey cried,
"You hurt me. You hurt my arm."
Mike's yowling and the metallic clanging of the lockers had stirred up everyone in and around Ward 6. Fred Mouse was squeaking, "Yip, yip, yip." Quarter to Ten was spinning, and Randy was way under his bed, keening as if his throat had been slit. And now Nurse Mimi was in the doorway. From behind her, Dr. Hoover pushed his way into the room. He yelled,
"Freeze!"
Nettie stepped away from Mike, who had collapsed in a damp, pea-smelling heap of dummy. Nurse Mimi went to Mike, and he wailed,
"Nettie broke my arm!"
Dr. Hoover loomed above Nettie and said,
"Your privileges are suspended, Edward. Effective now."
Nettie joined the big fat baby chorus, crying in his peculiar high-pitched whine.
"He started it! I didn't mean to hurt him! It was an accident! I'm sorry, Mikey!"
Nurse Mimi said,
"Dr. Hoover, I believe him. Nettie never acts up. He's a sweetie, aren't you, dear?"
Hoover said to Mike,
"Michael, you're going to St. Vartan's, okay? Nurse Mimi, get a chair and take Mike to the ER.
He turned back to Nettie and said,
"Edward, you're confined to the infirmary at night until further notice. Give me the keys to the alley."
"Keys? No, Dr. Hoover, please, the keys are mine."
Hoover stuck out his hand.
"Now, Edward."
Nettie took his precious keys, his flight pass, from the hook in his locker, and handed them to the doctor.
"Get your pillow."
Nettie plucked his pillow from his bed, and clutching it, he walked ahead of Dr. Hoover down the speckled lino hallway, past the nurse's station to the men's infirmary.
"When can I come out, Dr. Hoover? When can I have my privileges back?"
"Behave, Edward. I'll come for you in the morning and we will have a talk. Leave everything else to me."
"Yes, okay, okay, doctor."
Nettie sat on the edge of the bed, assuming a posture that made him appear as meek and as harmless as a small, middle-aged Looney Tune could look. The infirmary door closed and locked. He waited for the peephole to open and close, and once he was finally alone, Nettie held onto his head, and when he couldn't suppress the pain, he raged around the very small room, which was four times the size of the dog kennel he'd slept in at Johnston. He knew that his situation had hit a patch of bad weather. Dangerous winds, electric thunderstorms, isolated tornadoes. None of that would get in his way. Did Hoover think that he was such a dummy that in all these long years at the bin he'd never gotten spare keys? If Hoover knew where he'd gotten the sucks, he'd probably kill himself. Nettie flapped his arms and raged and made plans. Chapter 75. I was halfway into my drive to the hall through morning rush when Claire called.
"I've got good news, and I've got bad news."
I couldn't read her tone of voice. I jerked the wheel left-right to avoid a pothole and continued up Masonic Avenue. "Bad news first," I said. "Give it to me straight. I can handle anything, and I prove it every single day." Claire laughed.
"You're my hero, Lindsay."
"Yeah, yeah, hit me, butterfly."
"Ready?" "There were no usable prints on the run-over, crushed-to-powder sucks vial, and no DNA on it either."
"Oh, great. I'm having a hard time imagining the good news."
"Brace yourself.
I know where that vial came from. The lot number told me so."
"Yahoo!"
This wasn't a case of good news. This was a case of fantastic, groundbreaking, possibly case-breaking news.
"You're my hero," I said to Claire.
"Oh, shut up," she said. And then we both laughed. As soon as I arrived at the squad room, I briefed Rich and Brady, who stood up, clapped his hands together, and said,
"Get on out of here. Don't forget to phone in."
Rich and I stopped at Claire's office for a photocopy of the vial label with the lot code. And then we took off. St. Vartan's is a big, well-respected teaching hospital that takes up the whole block between Pine and Bush. When I say it's big, I mean 14 floors, 300 beds, 180 physicians, and 1,000 employees. That big. After my partner and I cleared the expected bureaucratic steeplechase, we met with Dr. Merrily Christensen, the director in charge of the hospital's in-house pharmacy. Dr. Christensen was a tightly wrapped 60-something woman, all business, moderately defensive as she explained the storage and dispensing system at St. Vartan's in-house pharmacy. She ticked off the protocols, including the passwords, key cards, and required records every time a unit of medication was moved from locked drawers and cabinets to mobile carts. Conklin said,
"Dr. Christensen, we're trying to track the source of a vial that was sold to St. Vartan's and was found on the street. It may be evidence in a murder. Please take a look."
I handed her the copy of the sucks vial label, with its 10-number code highlighted in yellow.
"Can you wait?"
she asked. She left her desk and returned only 10 minutes later.
"This product expired last year. This lot was destroyed."
I said,
"All except for this vial?"
"Naturally," she huffed.
"I can't account for individual vials, but what remained of this case lot is on our destroyed in-house list."
Conklin, the best guy with women I've ever met, pushed his brown hair out of his eyes and asked a number of questions.
"Where and how are expired drugs destroyed? Was it possible for those vials to be stolen after they left the pharmacy? Could they have been lifted, for instance, from the OR? How long is sucks effective after its expiration date?"
Dr. Christensen replied in depth. "No one could have stolen the vial from the dispensary without leaving a trail, and no such trail had lit up the tracking software. That went for the surgery unit, too. St. Vartan's had a facility in the basement, an incinerator cleared by the DEA that was dedicated to destroying expired drugs. Records were meticulously made and maintained, of course.
Of course, Conklin said.
Christensen went on.
Sox would still be effective for 5 to 8 months after expiry. After that, the potency would be diminished.
But it would still paralyze an individual who was injected with it? I asked.
Of course. But we would never use a drug after the manufacturer's expiry date, okay?
I've got to get back to work, she said with finality.
Conklin asked to see the drug disposal facility so we could complete our report. Christensen made a call, and Kelly Kane, a young pharmacy assistant, took us down to the B level. The elevator doors opened. I wasn't prepared for my first look at what lurked beneath St. Vartan's. The basement wasn't just huge. It sprawled. It had high ceilings and many Alice in Wonderland doors. It had the look of an underground city. Chapter 76. I tried to take in the vast, humming, industrial-grade basement level under St. Vartan's. The off-white painted walls were notched at intervals with intersections and blue doors that led to the boiler room, cooling apparatus, maintenance services, kitchen facilities, laundry. Pipes and tubes scaled the 20-foot-high ceilings, which were paneled with fluorescent lighting that bleached this mechanical underworld and polished it to a high shine. Along with the thumping of the major pumps and the chopping of fans, there was traffic aplenty. Maintenance workers, kitchen workers, and orderlies pushing wheelchairs and gurneys. Electric carts streaked past. Let me just say that the almost futuristic, machine-driven quality of the place was a little creepy. I looked to Conklin to see how he was taking it, and saw that Kelly Kane had fixed her big brown eyes on Inspector Hottie and had sidled up inside his personal zone. I butted in. The incineration facility? I reminded her.
Right this way.
We followed the young woman down the main corridor, came to an intersection, and turned right down a spur of hallway to a door marked furnace room. We peered through a window in that door and saw a large, blocky furnace in use. A maintenance worker opened the adjacent storage room for us. A logbook was prominently positioned beside a computer on a long table. Shelves wrapping around three sides of the room were stacked with drugs that had been consigned to the fire. There were locks on both doors, and an operator was present most of the time, according to Kelly. I asked, what does most mean?
18 hours a day, but the doors are always locked 100%.
But maybe the man with the key took a break now and then. My excitement over tracking the sucks to its last known whereabouts had cooled. What now? As we walked back toward the elevator, Kelly was saying to Conklin,
You're here about that stealth killer, right?
He said,
Could be. Any thoughts on that?
Well, Kelly said, blinking up at my partner, I probably shouldn't say this, but I saw an aide sneaking around down here a couple weeks ago after the storage room was closed for the day.
Really? I said, my enthusiasm warming up a touch. You know the name of this aide?
Doreen something.
What does Doreen look like? Kelly said.
About my height, blonde, hippie.
We had been looking for a man, but could the woman Kelly described have passed as a weird-looking dude? She said,
Doreen works at the loony bin. That's the psych ward? It's across Hyde and around the corner on Bush. Red brick compound with a wrought iron fence out front. There's a shortcut to the bin through our basement, you know?
Didn't know,
Conklin said.
That's very interesting, Kelly.
Yeah, this corridor goes directly to Hyde Street Psychiatric, she said, pointing over my shoulder. Psych patients are transported from the hospital to the bin and vice versa. Like Doreen could have come from the bin to the furnace and no one would know. Ready to go back upstairs? She asked.
Conklin said,
I think we'll take the Hyde Street detour. Thanks for your help. We appreciate it.
As my partner and I struck out along the underground route to the psychiatric hospital, the little voice in my head was pleading, Doreen something, are you our killer? Please, God, give us a sign. Chapter 77. I had been feeling that we were playing beat the clock with the stealth killer, that this maniac could be winding up for another random hit. Was it possible that he was close by? That he worked at the Hyde Street Psychiatric Center? Conklin and I found Dr. Terry Hoover in the common room of the center's North Ward. He was tall and bespectacled, wore his tie loosely knotted and his shirt sleeves rolled to the elbows. He waved us into his glass-walled office, which had a 360-degree view of the busy corridor that ran past Ward 6 and the nurse's station. He kept his eyes on all 360 degrees as we spoke with him. I downplayed our reason for this sudden visit by the SFPD, telling Dr. Hoover that Conklin and I were investigating illegal use of succinylcholine, that an empty vial of sucks found near a murder scene had led us to St. Vartan's. I explained that the vial had come from an expired lot that had been marked for destruction in the hospital furnace. While we were at St. Vartan's, we were told that one of your nurse's aides had been seen poking around their drug incinerator.
One of our aides? I don't understand. Wait, this isn't about those murders I read about.
We just have to check it out, I said to the doctor. What can you tell us about a nurse's aide, first named Doreen?
Doreen Collins. She's been with us for about 4 years. A very kind woman. I can't imagine why she would be anywhere near the furnace, said Hoover. Does she need a lawyer?
No,
said Conklin. We just want to ask her a few questions. Let me talk to her, said Hoover.
Conklin and I went with the doctor down the long hallway to a busy ward where Doreen Collins was massaging a patient's hands. She looked to be about 30, wide through the hips, not more than 5'2", with short, choppy blonde hair. Hoover said to the patient,
I'm sorry, Mr. Fritz. I need a few words with Doreen.
The nurse's aide came over to us and she looked terrified.
Why?
Hoover asked,
Doreen, these are police officers looking into missing succinylcholine. Do you know anything about that?
She shook her head vigorously and said, No, I don't know anything. Why would anyone want sux? Why are you asking me? Hoover said,
Apparently someone saw you hanging around the furnace in the basement.
The woman's hands went to her face, and she dissolved straight into tears.
I'm diabetic, she said. I'm sorry, Dr. Hoover, I was looking for insulin. The door was locked. I punched in my code, and when it didn't work, I left. I didn't take anything.
Please don't do that again, Doreen. Stealing drugs will get you fired. Expired insulin could get you killed. Do you understand?
Hoover took his eyes off Ms. Collins, flicked them past the crowd of patients and staff who were slow walking past the doorway. He said,
Sergeant Doreen is, in fact, diabetic. She has a perfect performance record at Hyde Street Psych. Is she a suspect?
Doreen said,
I only did this once. I swear to God I didn't take anything. I swear to God.
Chapter 78. Conklin and I questioned Ms. Collins in an exam room down the corridor from Dr. Hoover's office. She accounted for her whereabouts at the time Mr. Beardsley was killed. She said she had been here at Hyde Street Psychiatric, had reported to the nurse's station at 4 in the afternoon, and had worked with patients and other staff members, not leaving the center until midnight when she punched out. She took us to her locker, opened her handbag, and showed us her time card. And while we were there, she gave us a go-ahead to search her bag and her locker. In short, she had a solid alibi for the time of Beardsley's death. I took her contact info as well as that of her mother and roommate, gave her my card, and asked her to call us if she had any ideas that might help the SFPD. Conklin and I returned to Dr. Hoover's office. He was distracted, and after we gave him our cards, he was done.
I don't see how I can help you further,
he said with finality. We left Hoover in his office and edged through a swarm of milling patients in the common room, one of whom came up to us. His hair was silver-shot blonde. I made him to be 5'4", 130, and possibly in his 50s. He had an awkward stance, proportionately short arms, and an overall gnome-like appearance.
I'm Nettie,
he said in a high-pitched cartoonish voice. He grinned at me.
I'm good. Are you good?
I smiled back at him and said, Hi, Nettie. Everyone is good. I looked around at the other patients in Dr. Hoover's ward and saw people with obvious challenges and others who looked as normal as anyone in any crowd. Some of the patients wandered, some played games, one sang the Star-Spangled Banner while lying in the intersection of two corridors. Another group watched Dr. Phil on TV. There was noise all around, but my internal alarms were quiet. What I now knew about St. Vartan's and this psych center led me to conclude that we had both too many suspects and none whatsoever. Conklin and I made our way out of the labyrinthine Hyde Street Psychiatric Center. Out on the street, I said to my partner, I hate square one.
Let's grab lunch, Conklin said. I think better when I'm not half starving.
Copy that. Chapter 79. Nettie watched the two cops talking to Doreen Collins and heard her crying,
I'm diabetic. I'm sorry, Dr. Hoover. I was looking for insulin.
Nettie was paralyzed by panic. Cops were here, right here. He didn't get it at all. What had brought them to the bin, and why were they grilling Doreen? The vial of sucks he'd stupidly dropped. That was coded. They'd traced it to the hospital, and the rest of it came together in a horrible, stinking flash. He'd been seen, either when he stuck the woman outside the Admiral Dewey, or maybe when he stuck the football player dude. He had gotten careless. Someone had seen him and described him to the cops. This was bad. He'd known Doreen casually for 4 years, but now he saw that they resembled each other in the grossest, most general way. Both of them were short and blondish. But Nettie was pretty sure that once the cops talked to Doreen, they'd know how stupid she was. Too thick to pull off murder under any circumstances. And elegant murders? Never. Another thought struck him. Mikey had told Hoover about his night flights. Would Hoover tell the cops that he disappeared sometimes all night long? He went cold and numb just thinking about that. Hoover was very smart, but he was arrogant. Nettie had been the perfect idiot for so long. Would Hoover even consider that Nettie was a killer? No. No, 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 never. Or was this his own arrogance speaking? He had to check on this to be sure. He wanted to see Hoover's expression. He wanted to see the cops' eyes when they looked at him. It was compulsive, he knew, but he'd learned many lessons during his lifetime in lockup. One of those lessons was how to read faces. He would know if he was a suspect when he looked into the eyes of those cops. Nettie cut through the little gang of gawkers outside Hoover's office and approached the two cops, a man and a woman who could have been the two cops who had stopped him on the patio outside the Waterside restaurant.
I'm Nettie,
he said in squeak mode.
I'm good. Are you good?
Hoover's voice boomed.
Nettie, Carlos, Tommy, please clear the hallway. Thank you.
The tall blonde woman cop looked Nettie in the eyes, checking him out, maybe asking herself, is this one a killer? Then she smiled at him, dismissing Nettie as everyone always did. Hi, Nettie. Everyone is good, she said. Could he count on that? He still had his spare keys. They hadn't found the sucks he'd plucked from the cart in the electroconvulsive unit at the end of the hall. The cops had nothing on him. He could run. Where would he go? Chapter 80. Connor Grant hummed and sang along with Pavarotti over his sound system as he packed for his liftoff to obscurity. His ribs ached. The right side of his jaw was still shades of green and blue, but his week-old beard disguised the remains of the beatdown, and he was moving around just fine. He came down from his bedroom with the bag that he had packed with a few basics, enough for about 4 days, which he would ditch as soon as he got overseas. Inside his office, with the tenor keeping him company, he swung open the hinged bookcase and tapped the digital code into the wall safe behind it. He removed a banded stack of currency, a half-dozen credit cards embossed with assorted names, several passports, and a one-way first-class plane ticket to Zurich. He slipped the ticket and chosen passport into the inside breast pocket of his cheerful blue jacket. The small fireplace was working on some notebooks he'd piled in pyramid fashion, and the blaze was at a nice, steady burn. He grabbed a few files from his desk drawers and fed them to the flames. It was time to get rid of all his souvenirs, the clippings of the original fire back in Maynard, Wisconsin. His memories were vivid enough. He'd started a grass fire that had traveled across the small yard, lighting up a propane tank, which blew up the small wood frame house, killing everyone inside. Mother, father, and little brother Lane Kingsley. Ninth grader Adam Kingsley had set the fire. He watched the shattering of glass and the explosion and the inferno that burned until nothing was left. Even the human remains were unidentifiable. He'd never cared for his family, and they hadn't cared for him either. As a breeze blew across the cinders and ash, he saw an opportunity to become someone else. Someone better. He hitched to Michigan, took on a new name, dummied up a birth certificate, and convinced Ann Arbor Senior High to let him into the 11th grade. The next year, he got a driver's license at the DMV. He started college that year, and 4 years later, when a car bomb killed 3 kids in the senior class, and he was presumed to be a 4th person in that car, he took on a new identity in a new town. By the time he graduated from the University of Miami School of Law as Sam Marks, he had perfected his methods of switching lives. Missing persons, dead babies, unidentifiable victims of fires and explosions that he'd set, all became his cash flow and the framework for new lives. When his pièce de résistance, the Cytron explosion, sucked up all the available fire and rescue manpower in San Francisco, no one thought about the apartment fire in Knob Hill that burned up the remains of a bachelor, Jonathan Bishop, as well as several other people living in that building. The real Jonathan Bishop had been an investment banker, and although his body was ashes now, his life story would carry on. Connor Grant gathered up his folder containing documents of Jonathan Bishop's life and dropped them into his bag. Jonathan Bishop's history was filling his mind, his career path and family history, the well-planned and fortunate life of an elite one percenter in America. And so what to do with his own remains? Grant crossed the small room to the photo gallery over the credenza. He lifted the few framed photos down from the wall. Pictures of himself as a child. The seductive shot of his third ex-wife, R.I.P. The only picture he had of the Kingsleys, and in the back of the frame, behind the cardboard, was Sam Marks's diploma from the University of Miami. They had to go. He removed the photos and the diploma from their frames, then put them into the fire. Jonathan Bishop wouldn't need them in Zurich. Grant stirred the fire with a poker. Then he took all his backup CDs and broke them up. He had already wiped his hard drive. It was sparkling clean and would come with him overseas. Bye-bye, Connor Grant. He was panting a little, sweating from the heat of the fire when he made iced tea. He took the glass back to the easy chair in his living room and sipped tea until the guttering flames died. As an afterthought, he pulled a book on international banking from the bookshelf and tossed that into the bag and zipped it up. The man still known as Connor Grant was elated to be leaving town. But he wouldn't ship out without giving San Francisco a great big kiss goodbye. Chapter 81. Grant left his blue and white little granny house through the kitchen door and stepped out into the driveway. His large canvas duffel bag was where he had left it, on a luggage trolley beside his old Hyundai. He tossed his travel bag into the front seat, carefully loaded the duffel into the trunk, and folded up the trolley, which he fit into the trunk on top of the duffel. Reaching behind him, he took his semi-auto handgun out of his waistband and secured it under the driver's seat. Done, done, and done. He walked over the gravel drive and out to the front yard. The uniformed officers were parked in their patrol car at the curb, coffee containers in hand, car radio on full blast. Officer Brad Jamison was a rookie. His partner, Ray Baxter, was an old-timer. The two of them together didn't have the brain power of a mosquito. This was San Francisco PD's idea of protection.
"Officers," he said, "I'm taking Sergeant Boxer's advice. Leaving my house and checking into a hotel for a while. My insurance company is paying for it."
Well, that's fine, Mr. Grant. You should let Sergeant Boxer know where you're off to.
Already did it, said Grant.
You need any help with your luggage or anything?
Officer Baxter asked.
No thanks.
So where are we going?
Not we. Just little old me. Like I told the sergeant, I won't be needing protection for a couple of weeks. I'll stay at the Marriott while I look for a new place.
Jameson said,
Okie doke. You should also fill out a form at the post office so they hold your mail.
Good idea. So thanks for, thanks.
It was noon when Grant turned out of his driveway and headed toward Bay Shore Boulevard. He drove carefully. No mistakes now.